I think fundamentally we need more role models. The idea that there weren't women in computer science is absolutely wrong. In fact, in the beginning, a lot of computer scientists were women and they were pioneers. Mm-hmm. Like Ada Lovelace, who wrote the very first computer program, Grace Hopper, who wrote the very first compiler, Ray Montague, who worked at the Navy and was the first person to design an entire naval ship with a computer after all the people who had been working there had been unable to do it for the longest time. And Margaret Hamilton, who coined the term software engineering in the very first place, right? What's happened over time is that we've lost a lot of those role models. And so there has become this impression that maybe women are not as interested in it, or maybe not as capable in it, or maybe is not as successful in it, and it is fundamentally wrong. And so I think as women keep pushing and as men are really helping to support that, we can start to get more role models again.
Welcome to Life on Brand, where builders and breakers share how they live life on their own terms.
As always, the show is brought to you by the Huck Finch boys, Matt and Hein. Check us out at huckfinch.com. Again, that website is huckfinch.com. And also, subscribe to the show because you know you want to.
All right, let's jump right in.
Hey everybody, Hein here. I want to tell you about a brand new web series that Matt and I just started called Bourbon and Brand. Every week, Matt and I sit down to nerd out on a topic related to branding, from logos to how to create a brand strategy, and everything in between, all while sipping America's national spirit, bourbon. Check out the show at huckfinch.com/bourbon. Again, that website is huckfinch.com/bourbon. Cheers.
We're here today with Don Verbrugge, founder and CEO of Jotful, a growing startup in Ann Arbor that seeks to help every small business to be found and tell their story online. Before that, she did everything from founding a fashion company to teaching at the Parsons School of Design in New York. We're also fortunate enough to be joined by Natalie Bruno, the customer and business dev lead at Jotful, to help tell the full story. We're really excited to finally sit down with you two. Don, you've been elusive to us, at least in person. So we're really excited to actually sit down, have a formal conversation. We've talked with Natalie a bunch before, but excited to dig into your story and how Jotful sort of came to be. So thank you two for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you. Everybody gets to speak to Natalie because she's everywhere.
She is everywhere.
We saw you at Pitch Club. We were going to make an honest effort to say hi to you, and then you stealthily walked out
after the food was done.
Yeah,
we were all distracted by the food. We looked away to get like a taco or something, and then the chance was gone.
Yeah,
we wanted to start just by talking about before your entrepreneurial days, of which mm-hmm. there are many. You kind of dove headfirst, academically at least, into design and business. What drew you to those areas initially?
Mm-hmm. So I think the business aspect was pretty inevitable because my parents were small business owners growing up. And frankly, it's the only thing I ever knew was owning your own business. So I might have strayed from that for a while, but it seemed pretty inevitable. And ultimately, that's what I did in graduate school. Design, however, was a fluke. I'm from the Upper Peninsula, and design was never sort of a subject that anybody studied or thought about. But I had been doing a lot of computer programming in school, right? So I started learning BASIC in the fourth grade and then Fortran in the seventh grade. And then I came here for college in Ann Arbor, and my first semester I took a class in Pascal. And I thought I wanted to be a software engineer, and I took that Pascal class and realized, that's not what I actually like about programming. What I liked was creating things. And in high school, I had been the person in charge of creating all the programs for all the sporting events, you know, like all the basketball games and all that stuff. And I was using early desktop publishing software for that. And I realized that there was this aspect of it that I really liked. And in one of those sort of serendipitous things, the girl across the hall from me in my dormitory was studying something called graphic design. And she was in the art school, which was a school. And it turns out it was just down the street from where I was living on North Campus. So I started taking some art classes my second semester and realized, well, it turns out I can draw. And I had never done any drawing before, but it's something that can be taught and learned. And so I did that and had enough to build a portfolio, and I was able to get into design school. And ultimately, that's how I ended up in design. It was one of those strange things.
It's so funny you mentioned the word flute, because I think that experience, mm-hmm. at least for me as well, is like one of the best parts of college. There's like a lot of opportunity yeah. for like fluky things to happen that shape yeah. what course you thought you're on. So I always yeah. found those kind of like fluke stories interesting.
My high school was so small, right? You know, we were 42 people in my graduating class. Only a handful of us went to college. But we were small enough that when we walked across the stage to pick up our diploma, they would announce what we were doing after graduation, right? And so everybody had a plan, right? Like so-and-so is going into the military. So-and-so is seeking employment in the local area. And the people who were going to college all had a major, right? They're going into nursing usually, or they're going to be a teacher and they're going into education. And here I was walking across the stage. I was the valedictorian and I was undeclared. Right? I was like the one person in the class who had no idea what she wanted to do with her future.
So speaking of teaching and education, you eventually found your way to teaching at Parsons. Can you talk a little bit about that experience and how that came to be?
The way it came about is that I was asked to guest lecture in a class. And after the guest lecture, the professor said to me, "Have you ever thought about teaching?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I've always thought about teaching. It was the kind of thing that has always interested me and thought I would enjoy, but sort of never had the opportunity to pursue." This particular program at Parsons is very unusual. It's kind of a three-legged stool. Mm-hmm. It's a business degree, but the students take design classes, liberal arts classes, and management classes. And so I ended up getting a role in the management faculty there and started teaching there. And initially I taught first year students, so first semester freshmen coming in, and it was just fascinating. Like, so little of teaching at that point is about education, and most of it is about life.
Yeah.
Especially because for these students, it's their, well, for any students, their first time living away from their parents, yeah. right? But this is also New York City, this unbelievably distracting place. And just over time, just working yeah. with the administration, you know, one class here, one class there, yeah. and then started kind of moving on. I was one of the few faculty members who actually really liked teaching freshmen. Most people most people tried to avoid right. those classes. So I was surprised when they started to let me teach other classes. But if you've been there for a while, you get a certain seniority and you start to get to choose what you want to teach. And so I took advantage of that and ultimately ended up teaching a course called Business Models and Planning mm-hmm. almost exclusively. And so I'd work with my students on writing a business plan for an entrepreneurial venture, which was fantastic.
How did the guest lecture opportunity come about?
The professor was married to a friend of mine. As such fluke. Things, another fluke, right? Like, as such things come about. And the person that he was married to and I were the only two people in our MBA program who had Bachelor of Fine Arts degrees as undergrads. It's an extremely unusual combination to have yeah. a Fine Arts bachelor's and then an MBA. So yeah. That made me naturally attractive to teaching in this particular Parsons sure. program.
With your parents being small business owners, do you remember like getting the entrepreneurial itch?
I can't think of a time when I didn't imagine that someday I would have my own business, even if I couldn't have articulated it as such. I can't think of a time when that wasn't a possibility. My parents involved us a lot in their businesses, which I think is fantastic. And I know a lot of people say, maybe you shouldn't bring your children to work, but we were working, yeah. right? We were like the definition of slave labor. Like we didn't get paid and we were working all the time. And I remember my mother used to own a flower shop, and my sister and I were in charge of cleaning it on the weekends, right? And one time in the local newspaper, which is almost kind of like a comic newspaper as much as it is a real newspaper. I don't know how to describe it. It's a very Upper Peninsula thing. But they did sort of a best of Alger County section. And we were named best place to take a leak in Alger County. My mom's flower shop. And my sister and I were like, wow, we cleaned those bathrooms.
That is a very entrepreneur's way to look at that. You're like,
exactly.
Who cleaned those bathrooms?
We did.
We put this whole thing on the map.
Exactly.
Did you get a pay raise after you guys got that award?
No, we received $15 a week. It was kind of our, like our allowance, but yeah we got it for cleaning. It's funny with my students at Parsons, and especially once I started teaching seniors, I learned after a few class sessions, they didn't know the difference between revenue and profit. Mm-hmm. And this was shocking to me because I can't think of a time in my whole life when I have not known the difference between revenue and profit. Because when your parents are small business owners, it's just part of the language that you grow up with.
To be your lead on your LinkedIn profile, I feel like it's still...
You're so awesome. Right.
Speaking of your LinkedIn profile, another thing that you had in kind of your tagline description, is just the description of yourself as a mentor, which stands out to us. Like, we've had mentors and just people who have helped us along the way. It's been incredibly important. So interested to hear your take on that, both as a mentor and maybe advice on finding a mentor.
You have to have mentors. There are only so many books you can read. I'm a voracious reader, which we'll get to later, but there's no substitute for learning from other people's mistakes. It's just a lot less expensive and a lot faster. Yeah. So I happen to have some really fantastic mentors, and I lean on them for different things, right? So each one of them has kind of an area of expertise that I go to them for. Like, there's one person who I talk to about management stuff. Mm-hmm. There's one person that we talk to actually as a business about marketing stuff. Mm-hmm. And there's another person that Jotful talks to about sales stuff, right? Like, we have these kinds of touch points. They're kind of our go-to people. Mm-hmm. And I really believe you can't be successful as an entrepreneur without great mentors. And so I try to be a great mentor for other people. And I think because I taught at Parsons, I have this real affinity for millennials. I watched my students and they were working so much harder than I ever worked in college. And grades are so much more important for them than they were for me. Like, I never cared about my grades. I just wanted to learn. Mm-hmm. But for my students, the grades were essential because employers look at them now in a way that they didn't when I was coming out. Graduate schools look at them now in a way that they didn't even when I got my MBA. And my students were all doing all of these internships. They were doing internships not only all summer, but also all school year. And because a lot of them were doing fashion internships, the hours were just insane. And so I looked at my students and I thought, I don't know why people are constantly like crapping on millennials.
It's great to hear millennials talked about glowingly from time to time, like you said, because there's this negative connotation, and I don't think a lot of us are totally sure why, other than like we have a lot of phones interaction.
How would you recommend somebody like reach out to somebody potentially to be a mentor?
Yeah, I don't have really good advice on that, to be honest. Like, I know that I've worked at larger companies where there have been these formal mentorship programs, and I've never actually seen them work. Because it feels a little bit forced. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's very forced, right? Very forced. All the mentors that I've got have been relationships that have developed slowly, right? And you kind of earn the right to be a mentee by asking good questions that they can actually answer and be helpful with. And mentors want to help, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they really, really want to help. And then sort of over time, if you establish that relationship, that's the only way I've ever seen it work.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree too. I think like I learned a lot later in life, I guess, unfortunately, but in that right way of just people that really do want to help.
I'll jump in on this one because I mentor a lot of people, and I've also been really lucky to have incredible mentors throughout my life. And I talk with a lot of people who are sort of in career journey mode. Mm-hmm. And so I'm talking to them a fair amount about this particular question. And I'm a huge fan of the informational interview. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people, I think, don't know that you can really do that, or I think that maybe you have to be looking for a job to do that. But for some of the people that I'm talking to, they're new in their different areas and they don't have a big network. And so I'll suggest, here are just a few people that you might talk to. And they look at me with like these scared eyes. And so then I have to say, here's a way that you can ask. Yeah. And also I'll do a warm introduction for you, but make sure you show up with great questions and then make sure you ask that person, are there maybe one or two other people that you might introduce me to? So that basically you're doing all of these informational interviews with people, asking questions, doing the follow-up, and then naturally you're going to be drawn to people who are also drawn to you. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be successful for young people who are looking for, how do I break into this world of finding mentors?
I love just the idea of like asking, like, all right, if there are a couple of people.
Yeah, always.
Just tapping in again to like, people are generally interested in helping you do that, even if they're not the mentor, like they might know somebody else that you click with. So
exactly. That's great.
So the next thing we want to kind of jump into is building diversity in tech.
Yeah, and being, big topic. Yeah, right.
It's a huge topic right now. It's pretty much everything you hear about in every tech magazine like Forbes or Inc. It's really about how to create diversity. So one of the first times we saw your name, it was an article about taking a pledge to be a founder for change. Mm-hmm. So can you talk a little bit about that pledge and why it's important to you?
Yeah. So the whole point of the pledge is that founders are committing themselves and committing their businesses to diversity, right? And I know Natalie and I don't necessarily agree on this one aspect of it, but I think that if you don't have a diverse workplace, it's intentional. And you are intentionally not including people of other genders or other cultures and other races. And I know that it's hard to create diversity, but I do think that if you don't have diversity, you are doing something intentionally not to create it. Mm-hmm. And so we've just talked about some things that we could do as a company in order to create a more diverse culture. So one of those things, and by the way, my focus tends to be a little bit more on gender diversity. Mm-hmm. But one of those things is I feel like a lot of tech cultures actively turn away through subtle signals, people who do not look like the people who already work there. And it's done under the guise of culture, mm-hmm. or that having people who are similar is actually a good thing for the company because it creates a kind of culture. And I don't think that that's right. I think that there are, you know, a gazillion studies you can point to about how important diversity of opinions and stuff is. But some of those basic things are like just having beer on tap, not having a trash can in the bathroom, having ping pong tables. Like all of these things are just subtle indications that this is a place where, this is a place for men to work, right? They just are. I don't know if you agree with that. Yeah. So there's that. And then there are some other things that we've talked about doing that we hope to be able to do someday. Things like having yoga classes and Zumba classes on site. Natalie's the yoga person. I'm the Zumba person. Those are like our respective personalities right there. Break it down by that.
What is your exercise of choice?
Yeah, exactly. And then also no haggle salaries. So all my life, I have been worried that I'm making less money than the person sitting next to me. And in some cases, I found out that's actually true. And I've had to go back and argue to be compensated at the same level as the person sitting next to me. I don't want anybody ever working at Jotful to feel like they are making less money than the person sitting next to them, who's doing exactly the same job with exactly the same experience at exactly the same level because of some intrinsic fact, like their gender or their race or whatever. So we have something called no haggle salaries, which means this is the salary. It's not negotiable. And everybody at your level gets this salary. This is just what it is.
Yeah.
And then everybody can feel confident that they're being paid appropriately.
What are your thoughts about why it's difficult for there to be more diversity due to the fact that a lot of these entrepreneurs and startup founders, they don't really have the experience in leadership. And that, like, they don't know how to, like, really, like, work with somebody who is thinking differently in them or may suggest something that's different. Have you experienced this or seen this as a part of, like, why there may be some challenges with diversity?
I think for many entrepreneurs, they get into this world because they have a great idea. And normal mainstream America working in a corporation is just not right for them. It's not their wiring. And so they get into it really young and before they've necessarily had great mentors themselves. Mm-hmm. And so you just sort of learn on the fly and you figure it out. And a lot of times that piece of learning how to be a leader and how to be a mentor and how to continue learning and growing your own skill set at the same time as you're running this business is totally left out. So, I mean, you can look at somebody who you just interviewed, right? Rich Sheridan, who has really intentionally left that world and focused entirely on this in mm-hmm. building yes. Menlo. That's a really unusual model. And you can see what great effect it has. Most founders are not doing that. And they'll either sort of get bumped on the head enough times in this space that they look at things really differently, mm-hmm. Or they'll seek outside counsel, somebody to come in and guide them on how to do this better. But it's a real struggle for entrepreneurs out there mm-hmm. that we want this, difference of thought, and we're going to bring in people from the outside. And I've actually worked at two different companies where that was the case. And in the end, that's not really what they wanted. It's really hard to have people around the table who are going to challenge you and think differently and change the shape of the business that you've built. You know, you're not sure if that's going to be good or bad. So I mean, advice on this topic for any founder, I mean, lucky to work with Dawn and that you know, she doesn't fall into that. And I think we share a lot of the same values around this subject. Is just to make sure that you are taking time for the development of yourself, because if you don't, then you're going to have a leadership cap for you in the organization, and you will not have any other leaders around you who are ever able to be higher than your leadership cap. And so that is going to be the level of your leadership in your organization, right? So keep the door open for developing your own skills in the leadership realm in order to open up and bring in diverse voices who are going to be extraordinary in helping you get to the next level.
Yeah. And I think one aspect of improving your own skills is actually to work at companies of different sizes. Because a lot of times people will come out of college and they'll go right away to a startup. It's very exciting. And then they leap from that startup to the next startup to the next startup. And they've only seen a certain kind of company, which may be a not very diverse kind of company. It may be a company run by a leader who doesn't have a lot of experience, right? And I always encourage people to work at companies of all different sizes. I mean, I've worked with Samsung Electronics, where there's somebody whose job it was to work in the supply room and count how many post-it notes you checked out, right? Like you should work at companies like that so that you can see what leadership looks like at organizations of that size. And you can take that back as you're working at smaller organizations too.
Love that mention, like the idea of a leadership cap.
Yeah.
I think that is just like a really succinct way to put this. It's just like you can set that really low.
If
that's just where you sort of stop, you know, especially in startups, you go really fast and you're just solving whatever the problem of the day is a lot, but not growing yourself up. And so therefore, that's kind of where the whole business stops. I love the way that you described that.
Right. Dawn, you already started giving some advice about how people can improve their leadership skills in order to create more of a diverse culture. What are some other recommendations you may have as a whole to kind of help the tech community be more welcoming and diverse?
It's a tough question. I mean, I don't know if this is a way to help that, but I think fundamentally we need more role models, because not having enough role models is creating an impression that certain things are not achievable. And I came in today with a list of women who were firsts in computer science, like Ada Lovelace, who wrote the very first computer program, Grace Hopper, who wrote the very first compiler, Ray Montague, who worked at the Navy and was the first person to design an entire naval ship with a computer after all the people who had been working there had been unable to do it for the longest time. And Margaret Hamilton, who coined the term software engineering in the very first place, right? The idea that there weren't women in computer science is absolutely wrong. In fact, in the beginning, a lot of computer scientists were women and they were pioneers. But what's happened over time is that we've lost a lot of those role models. And so there has become this impression that maybe women are not as interested in it, or maybe not as capable in it, or maybe is not as successful in it, and it is fundamentally wrong. And so I think as women keep pushing and as men are really sort of helping to support that, we can start to get more role models again. The other sort of subtle sense of not belonging that a lot of tech companies create is not belonging for people who have families. A lot of times events are around drinking and they happen right after work, which is when, of course, a lot of people who have children need to get home and feed their children, right? And I think tech companies could do a lot more to be much more open to people who have families.
Agreed.
Yeah, that's great points. Just thinking about these, all the different types of diversity that we're talking about here. And it's just like, it's geared towards a very specific, for the most part, group of people that do a very specific types of things as well.
The role model comment like really resonated with me, because growing up as an Asian American, like there we don't really have a lot of role models to look at, like especially even in the media, like all I have are guys like Jackie Chan and Jet Li. Just if you're Asian, you have to do kung fu. It's like this is the options I have for role models, to kind of see like this person just has done something beyond just what is within the limitations that I know of. So I think like that idea of having role models who maybe like capture and inspire like what you believe and what you like value, like that's so inspiring and so key to have. And then, like, I can be like this person and see like there's a different path for me.
I think Ann Arbor is blessed with female leaders, especially in tech, as role models. Like, I cannot believe it. There was the report that just came out this past week, and Ann Arbor, Michigan has the highest percentage of women who have raised venture capital of any city in the country. Ooh, right? Yeah. I mean, I'm shocked by the number of women and the strength of the women in leadership roles here.
Yeah. It was, I don't know if I had seen that article shared on LinkedIn or something to you, but it was really cool. I think I saw it the day after International Women's Day.
Yeah.
You know, maybe timed with that for PR reasons, but like that was a really cool thing aside from like Ann Arbor is full of a bunch of really smart people, which is like, that's really cool too. But it was nice to see the recognition attached to something a little bit less generic and more interesting, especially as it relates to the tech community. I think that's really unique, truly unique.
Well, now we're talking about Ann Arbor and women-owned businesses. Let's talk a little bit more about your business.
Uh-huh.
So tell us a little bit more about Jobful's background and why you started it in the first place.
Yeah. So it's funny because I feel like we tell this story all the time, right? And so some people listening are probably going to be like, oh, she's going to do that whole dress thing again. But about a year and a half ago, I had this idea that, or this hypothesis rather, that there were probably a lot of other businesses like my mom's business, which is a bridal shop up in the Upper Peninsula, that needed a website, but couldn't afford to hire a designer or an agency to build a website for them. It's just cost prohibitive. And we're never, ever, 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 ever going to build their own website using website builder software, because it's intimidating and it's software that they just don't want to bother learning how to use, right? They're running their business. My mom owns a bridal shop.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had been responsible for her website for years, but you know, life goes on and I don't have time to be managing my mother's website all the time, or like my uncle's salon website. You know, I do that for a lot of people. Yeah. And so I thought, well, there has to be, first of all, a market for this, right? Like other businesses that have this problem, and there has to be a way to serve them cost efficiently, right? With a product that delivers them a website and not just a builder that they can use to make their own website. So I, you know, hacked together a prototype and took it to the National Bridal Market in Chicago, which happens twice a year. And it's where all the bridal shop owners go to choose the dresses they're going to carry in their store for the next 6 months. And so I got a booth there. And it was booth full of dresses, booth full of like big wedding dresses. And then I had a booth with a table and a laptop and a sign that said, I can make you a website. And there was like another booth full of dresses, another booth full of dresses and so on. And I got the first handful of customers at this bridal show. So I went home and I built their websites, and I just built them on WordPress, like just using their CMS. But took what I learned from that process to figure out how we could scope out our own CMS or content management system that would allow us to do this very efficiently. And so then I hired an engineer named Jordan, who's phenomenal. And together we built it out and launched it in March of last year, March 2018. And then in June of 2018, we were invited to participate in the DeSci Accelerator. Or rather, we were accepted. I very aggressively campaigned for that. So we were accepted to participate. And as part of participating, we received an investment from the University of Michigan, which I then used to hire Natalie. And we can certainly talk about how Dawn met Natalie, because that's a fun story. And then together, you know, we just kind of, we went from there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I have to know how.
Yeah. You can't just drop that lead in and then not tell the story.
You know, I will say this to start. So, first of all, I keep a list of talent. I have a list on my computer of people who I just think are amazing. And maybe at some point, if I ever need somebody who does what they do, I will hire them in a second, right? Mm-hmm. So Natalie was there, like, at the top of the list. And I had just met Natalie once, maybe. Just once over coffee, but you know when you know, right? So I'll let you tell the story of like how we met.
So It was between two tech jobs for me. I was in the people operations space at two different tech companies, and I took a year in between there to search for who would be the right CEO, COO to support in the people operations and culture place. And so this journey was a long one and a really fun one. So I had maybe sat down with about 240 people that year on this sort of search for the right place. And the last person that I sat down with was Joe Malkoon, who was the CEO at Nutshell, and Dawn was the COO at the time. And so I got a job maybe 2 weeks later and didn't think much about it. But maybe a month or so later, this woman, Dawn, reaches out to me, and I think they were potentially looking at hiring an HR person. And I had just gotten another job, and so I decided I would always have a conversation. And so I had the same feelings about Dawn, although I'm not keeping a list of talent. But this is just a really impressive person, and I wanted to stay in touch. And so Dawn let me know maybe 3 or 4 months later that she was moving on. And we just, you know, wanted to intentionally stay in touch. When I decided to leave my last job, I reached back out to Ann Arbor and talked to a few people. Actually, Jonathan Goldstein is another one, and Rich Sheridan was the other one. Look at that. And so Dawn and I had a conversation. She was telling me about this interesting business that she was putting together, and, you know, its websites. And you know, I was interested in, you know, supporting a friend. And I was telling her, like, I'm probably going to make a move within the next 6 months or so. And Dawn said, well, nothing against you, but I hope nobody offers you a job in the next 6 months. I might have something for you.
Yeah.
And then she pursued pretty aggressively in the next couple of months.
After that. What she doesn't realize is that I was pursuing very aggressively even before that. All of those, like, hey, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? These were all intentional. And there are a couple of people, and Natalie knows quite well since she also went through my targeting process. There are also a couple of people that I'm doing that with right now. And I think some of them have clued into the fact, right? They're like, gosh, why doesn't she want me to leave my job? I'm like, don't look right now. It's not a good time.
It was a little while before this episode comes out. So they have a little, if they're still in the dark, they have a little more time.
Yeah.
Also a fun theme of like you passionately or aggressively pursuing the things that you want in this journey as well in the last two pieces. But it's always exciting to, I think, to just share like how just early stage like business partners meet and how those relationships form and why they're successful. I think it's always something we love to share with the audience because some people are on their own and trying to maybe figure out if that's the right thing or how they would go about that. So
I could skip ahead to one question then.
Sure.
You guys were going to ask me what I found surprisingly easy about starting this business. And actually that is the thing. So when I first started, I spent a ton of time and talked to a lot of my mentors about whether or not I should take on a co-founder. This is a huge decision for any entrepreneur. Yeah. It is a marriage. I kid you not.
Yeah.
So many businesses fail because the co-founding relationship simply doesn't work. And I've seen it over and over and over again in my career. So I was being very, very careful. And one of the books I was going to recommend, The Founder's Dilemmas, is actually really good on helping you understand all the impact of all the early decisions you need to make, right? And so I was like really very deliberately thinking about whether or not to take on a co-founder. And I just decided ultimately I haven't found the right co-founder. It doesn't make sense to sort of just take one for the sake of taking one because maybe a lot of venture capitalists think it's attractive when it's a founding team instead of a solo entrepreneur. So I'm just not going to do that. I'm just going to focus on building this business. And then I'm just really pleased to have like brought Natalie on as the first employee because she feels like a partner, right? In a way that, again, was surprisingly easy. I didn't go on a co-founder search. I just like stumbled across Natalie.
Yeah.
So that's so much about life, just stumbling onto it.
A lot of serendipitous like the story theme. Of this interview.
Yeah,
right?
Pretty much.
Yeah, exactly.
A lot of happenstance. So Matt and I are both absolutely obsessed with naming. So you guys have a cool name. How did the name Jotful come about?
Sure. So we all know small business owners. And if you run into them anywhere, you'll notice that they jot things down on pieces of paper, on napkins, on hands, on whatever it is. So that sort of jotting concept really works for the market that we serve. And what do? We try to bring joy to the process of having a website and getting it up and running, but you know, Joyful is not a domain that is available.
sure, just a lot of money. Yeah.
Rich Jordan probably has a lot of money.
He's looked into it.
Jotful reminds us of joy. I think the colors in our name and logo also bring joy, right? So it's a subtle reminder of what we do. But it also had an available domain.
Yeah.
as they all have, that's a factor of some percentage for almost everybody these days.
Yeah.
That's the piece of the story that Dawn likes
to
tell.
When I tell this story, it's usually, well, the domain was available. So was the trademark.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing the story behind the name. It really kind of helps lead into the next question. I think it ties it together, too, with the mission of the company to make it possible for every small business to be found and tell their story online. This is a really beautiful like mission statement that could really resonate with us. Was this kind of born out of a particular frustration? I think you kind of talked a little bit about your frustration of having to manage a million different people's websites.
Yeah, we recognized that there was just this enormous market of small business owners that were falling into this gap, right? Between agencies that cost too much and do-it-yourself software they're never going to do use to do it themselves, right? And so we knew that there was this enormous market there. And then on the other side, being findable online and having a professional presence online is just increasingly critical, even for Main Street small businesses, right? Especially as people are looking things up on their mobile phones. You don't exist if you don't have a website anymore, right? People can't find you if you don't put your street address with a Google Map driving directions on your website so they can click and their car can drive right to you. Mm-hmm. And so many small business owners were just being left behind. And we have an affinity for small business owners. We want them to succeed. And so we just wanted to be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The second part of the mission statement is being able to help these small businesses tell their story online.
Yeah.
Could you elaborate a little bit more about that part and how Jotful helps people tell their story?
A lot of small business owners, if they don't have a website, they're relying on something like Facebook or Yelp reviews, right? These other third-party sites to communicate basic details about their organization, like what their phone number is, what their street address is, reviews from customers, or kind of what their services are. But what these things miss is that ability to actually talk about what your brand is and what your mission is and why you exist and who works with you at your business. And we know as people who buy things at small businesses that we're really attracted to those stories, right? We, especially for local businesses, you really want to know who's behind it. And you can never tell those stories on those third-party platforms, right? It's only by having your own web presence that you control that you can really communicate that story fully.
In your own words, like what makes Jotful different?
So for example, compared to like a website do-it-yourself software like Wix or Squarespace, for example, or a GoDaddy like a lot of our customers actually use, there you get a piece of software and you get instructions online and you get some help people who will help you with the actual software. But what you don't get is guidance and advice on actually building it. So our customers generally are not design people, and they've learned marketing a little bit along the way because they've had to, right? But they're not marketers. And so they put something together, which is usually a frustrating process, wanting to pull their hair out, taking several months to do this and going, why am I doing this again? And then they get something that's just not as professional as they were hoping, like they thought it was going to be a little bit more magical than this.
Right. Yeah.
So I think the biggest differentiator here is we actually build it for them. And, you know, one of the things that we talk about, one we learned from one of our mentors is something that we just do as part of our offering is put a lot of marketing best practices into the website. So people don't necessarily know what a call to action is or why they would need it very clearly up front on their homepage. Or even just a line across the hero image that tells people what they do so they don't have to search throughout the entire homepage to maybe find a word that, you know. So it's that piece of it. And then it's, especially for small business owners, just the human touch to know that you're not going to just call to get somebody to tell you some technical thing about your website, but, you know, they can actually just ask a question that's from human to human, we have found is really important for our customers. So I think those are the two biggest differentiators.
I think you kind of captured it perfectly, Natalie, was the idea that it didn't, like, the current website doesn't turn out to be anything that, that captures them. So they're embarrassed about it. They want to be proud of their website because it captures their brand, who they are, what they value, their mission. So it's great that you guys are helping people do that.
So I think that concludes the Jatful portion, other than just kind of following up and thinking, is there any part of like the vision going forward that, you know, like you guys really have in mind? Like, you're pretty much a year officially, like this month, is that a little bit longer?
We celebrated 1 year in November.
Yeah,
when was
your official? Okay, so November,
yeah,
which is a huge milestone, but, you know, maybe a little bit like what the visionary part of it.
I'm laughing only because the last time we got this question.
Yeah, I knew that's what you were laughing about.
We talked about, you know, future international expansion, and that made it into the article. And then we got our first international customer
as a result of that article.
Oh, really? That's so funny.
Curious to hear what we're going to talk about now.
Just speak it into the world and then it will be so.
Yeah. The universe will deliver it, right? Yeah. Okay, so.
A pure serendipity.
We think. I think that ultimately we want to become a household name amongst our market, right? So for small business owners who are looking for a website, I hope that they are thinking of us ultimately in the same breath as they're thinking of some of the big do-it-yourself software companies today. We're fairly ambitious about that.
Yeah. So you're kind of entering our version of like the rapid fire questions, the slow burn. And we start with what we think is maybe the most important question to us, which is just, how do you define success personally? And this can be different or similar for you both, but just your personal definition of success.
Yeah, I define it as constantly growing and learning. So for me personally, and if I can help other people grow and learn, and this is something that Natalie and I talk about all the time at Jatful, that we want to create a culture where people can come in and maybe come in at first base and leave on third, right? And they've like sort of really like grown and learned through the process.
Yeah, that's awesome. Oh, we've never actually answered this question for one another, but I would answer it the same way.
Yeah.
I think as long as you are learning and growing, and I would add one piece to that, which is it's sort of a lifelong journey of getting to the most peaceful place that you can be as a as a human. I would call that success, whatever that means for you.
Yeah. That's great. It's like you guys should be in business together almost. So the next question is just describing when you experience doubt, either about starting this business or another business, or about having the right skill set to actually see through the idea that you had in your head.
Yeah. So the way I make decisions about things sometimes is to go after the thing I know nothing about and just learn whatever I can. And so I purposely chose a business school that was particularly strong in finance, because I had no finance background. So what that meant is that I was surrounded by people who came from investment banking and wanted to go back into investment banking and so forth, which means that my first corporate finance class in business school was this unbelievably intimidating class where everybody seemed to already know this language, which I did not know at all. And the professor told me, he said, don't worry, you know, someday it's just going to click for you and you're going to get it. And I thought, my goodness, I hope so. The days were ticking by and I still had no idea. But it is like learning a foreign language, and one day I could just speak it, right? And so I think that that was like the one thing where I had a ton of doubt. I really did not know. And, you know, here I had chosen the school based on its finance curriculum.
The next question is really about discussing a failure, and more importantly, a lesson learned from a failure. And again, it's open to either or both of you if you have one that's top of mind.
Yeah. So my first business, which you mentioned before, was in the fashion industry.
Yeah.
I made two mistakes there that I am not making again, right? The first one is that I started a business in an industry in which I knew nothing, nada. I learned everything from scratch. I'm not doing that this time, right? The learning curve is too high. Secondly, it was a service business because it was actually custom made to measure clothing. And I learned that I'm not suited for a service business. I want a product business because I'm really focused on growth. And with a product business, you can start to, especially a SaaS product business, right? Like you can really start to grow over time and build on what you did last year and build on what you did the previous year.
Yeah. I wish that people could have seen the facial expression you had when you said, "And I'm not doing that again." She meant it very clearly. Natalie, do you have any failure to point back to you? We want to let you off the hook if you have a fun failure or a lesson you learned from failure to share.
Sure.
like never failed.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I'll share a fun one from childhood. Early entrepreneurial spirit in me as a young kid. And so I sold my art that I would create to all the neighborhood parents. And then I realized that all the kids came and they had nothing to do. So the next year I put a bunch of games in place. So the parents bought the art and the kids would play the games. And so I did this every summer for 4 years, 5 years.
Very entrepreneurial.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. But after the first year, I was like pretty proud that I could do this. And I got a magic set for Christmas. And so I'm like, oh, I'm going to do also, in addition to this, I'm going to do a magic show this summer. So I learned as many of the tricks as I could. And, precocious child, got up there and had 30 kids in my garage and did this magic show. And I did not remember the last 10 tricks. So I had the book like down below, like, reading it and like turning the page and like trying to do the trick. Let's just say at the age of 10, I knew that that was pretty much a failure. Did not do the magic show.
The lesson learned was never to do magic.
Yeah, exactly.
No more magic.
No more magic in your life.
So, Dawn, you had touched on earlier the one thing you found surprisingly easy during the process of starting your business. Conversely, what's one thing you found surprisingly difficult? Again, in whatever version of your entrepreneurial life you wanted to touch on.
Yeah. I would say in my first business, I found everything surprisingly difficult because the first time you do it, everything seems so hard. And then the second time you do it, it's just not. So even things like choosing what type of organization to be. Should it be an LLC? Should it be a C corp? Should it be an S corp? And what is the difference between any of those, right? Like all of those little things when you're starting your first business are really like seem like mountains you have to climb. Hiring. I really struggled with hiring in the first business, attracting people. That's part of the reason why I now keep a list of talent. Finding customers, right? Like all of that was extremely, extremely difficult the first time around. But as I encourage people to go work at a very, very early stage company so they can watch somebody else figure all those things out so that when they go and start their own, they don't have to start from scratch.
Yeah, really great advice.
Yeah, there's always a lot to be learned in small or early stage businesses. Sometimes it's what not to do.
Right?
Exactly. It was going to be just as valuable.
Exactly.
That's pretty much how our business was set up, was pretty much to do, let's not do any of the things we didn't like about the place we worked at and see what comes out of that.
Yeah, just learning to solve like those things and how to maybe do them better when we had that opportunity.
Well, Natalie and I have also talked many times about different aspects of cultures we've worked in before that we don't intend to transplant at Joffle.
Yeah, sometimes the list of like what we're not or what we're not going to do is just as important as the one what we will. So we kind of cheated and talked a little bit about this question beforehand, but we're gonna ask it anyway, just because it wouldn't feel like the slow burn section if we didn't know. But the question is, what song that captures you as a person or as a company? Since we have two of you here, so we'll have two parts of that question.
All right. So I used to tell this joke, which I don't feel like I can tell anymore, and you'll see why in a moment. But I used to tell this joke because Jordan and Natalie, the first two people at the company, are both professional musicians. So Jordan plays the fiddle.
Yeah. Yes.
See, I don't even like always know the name of the instrument. So Jordan plays the fiddle professionally. And then Natalie played the trumpet. She's a trumpeter or trumpeteer. You can use both terms. Anyhow, so they are exceptionally musical, and I know nothing. I mean, where I grew up, we didn't have band. We had nothing. I know nothing about music. And so my joke was always that I can ask Alexa to play Michael Jackson songs. But now I feel like I can't even tell that.
Just the name of a new artist.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm going to like swap it out.
Yeah. Yeah. So Natalie, maybe you can paint a more musical picture with that setup.
Well, it's funny because when we for DeSci, there's like a demo day, which is when all of the startups get up and do the pitch that they've been working on all summer long. And so you get intro music and you get outro music. And so I actually thought Dawn would choose one of those as the songs that we chose as like her, one of her songs representing her. I am terrible, as she knows, about remembering song titles or artist titles.
The names of the Beatles. We have to tell that story.
That's where I was going with it. So, but to answer, it was Katy Perry's
Firework.
Yeah,
which is just a great song to walk into
absolutely.
The presentation.
Oh, yeah. Great holiday song. Yeah.
And then The Best Day of My Life.
Yeah.
Although I can't tell you who the artist is. So the funny story that's on this topic. Last Monday, we were talking to an attorney who has two sites. He has his law firm site, and he has a rock and roll podcast site.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
And so we're in the car together coming back from a meeting, and he at first asked us, oh, how old are you? And I'll tell you why I'm asking you in just a minute.
Yeah, which, by the way, an attorney should know you shouldn't ask.
Right? Yeah, no, like, yeah. That is a lead question.
It was pretty clear he knew he shouldn't, but he was just going to go there anyway. And so, you know, we said we're in our early 40s. Oh, good. Okay. So I want you to tell me the names of the four Beatles. And so I'm slowly starting with the first names. How about the last names? And then Dawn like quietly jumps in because she wasn't really on.
He didn't know I was on the call. But Natalie had no idea.
So she names all four Beatles first and last name. And he was impressed, but also thought, oh, you just looked it up on Google. And no. So we actually got the meeting with him because now we're able to do this.
Yeah, exactly. It was a sales call.
Musical trivia stuff before I go into this.
That was his qualifying question.
Yeah, I want somebody who knows something about what it is that I do in order to build my website.
That sounds like something I would do, minus the age question. I think.
Yeah.
I think I know at least at this point in my life I wouldn't lead with that. Maybe ease my way into the Beatles question.
You would just say you look old enough. You should know the names of.
Right.
Yeah. So thanks for getting through that question. Given what we had talked about, so. The next one is, we always ask a question from our previous guest. It's kind of cool because you all know our previous guest in this case. But the previous guest was Rich Sheridan, the founder of Menlo, here also in Ann Arbor. And he asked, what book have you read that had the most impact on you? And this can be, I think, maybe if there's a singular one to lead, but I think our audience always appreciates a good book list. So feel free to add as many as you'd like.
Yeah. So I'm sure that Rich was looking for something that has like sort of personally touched me and like driven my life journey or something like that. That's not at all what I've brought.
Sorry, Rich.
Sorry, Rich.
I'll answer it that way.
Yeah. Natalie will answer it that way. Exactly. I'm going to give the more Zumba answer and she'll give the yoga answer later. But people... I'm a voracious, voracious reader, as Natalie knows. Like, I'm starting 2 to 3 books a week. And so I keep a list of I keep a lot of lists, as you can see. But I keep a list of the books that I would recommend to any entrepreneur. And so this is my list. For entrepreneurial strategy, I always recommend Crossing the Chasm by Jeffrey Moore. I think I've read it at least 3 times. The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen. 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel. I'm not a huge fan of Peter Thiel, but I still have to recommend that book. It's so good.
I'm reading it right now, actually. It is it's pretty good. Yeah, I'm almost done.
Blue Ocean Strategy by W. Chan Kim and Renee Mulborn. She spoke here recently. She's a graduate of the university, and she has a new book out as well. And then just anything by Peter Drucker, right? Like The Essential Drucker or On Management. You just can't skip Peter Drucker. Yeah. So that's for sort of entrepreneurial strategy. I would read that before I started anything. And then these other books are all about the entrepreneurial journey. And I recommend reading them in this order, which kind of corresponds.
Perfect.
It kind of corresponds to sort of the stage that your business is in. Like, I usually like to read 1 or 2 stages ahead of where we are, but not any further than that.
Yeah.
So The Founder's Dilemmas by Noam Wasserman. I referred to this earlier. Like, it really lays out all the major decisions you'll need to make earlier on and helps you understand what the long-term impact of those decisions will be, like how you set up your business from a registration perspective, whether or not you get a co-founder, how you do your first hires, all those kinds of things. A couple of memoirs that I like, just because you get to hear how an entrepreneur actually experienced stuff. So Startup Land, which is by, I think he's pronounced Michaels Vaughn, and he's the founding CEO of Zendesk. And then The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz, classic, right? And those two are just really good at understanding the kinds of challenges that entrepreneurs come up against and how some other people have overcome them. I always recommend Venture Deals by Brad Feld and Jason Mendelsohn, because it's just the entrepreneur's Bible for all financing terms and everything VC related. I think for entrepreneurs talking to venture capitalists, it's totally unfair because they see so many deals and an entrepreneur does one deal, right? And so an entrepreneur really, really needs to catch up on the deal terms to be able to not have sort of that asymmetric information. And then two books that are really about scaling your business. So one is called High Growth Handbook by Eli Gill. And the other is called Blitz Scaling, which is a newer book actually out by Reid Hoffman. And both of these are about like how to just really take your business off. Like once you have product market fit and you have that initial traction, how do you begin to scale from there?
I love that you categorize them kind of in that phase. It's like we work with a lot of startups too. And it just is a very different set of problems, at least that are top of mind, depending on where you are. So it's really cool to have these books that might help you look a little bit ahead, but not too far. Natalie, here's your yoga response. We talked a little bit earlier before I think we started recording about how Dawn is Zumba personality as it pertains to her workout and how Natalie is yoga personality. So just for context to that.
Yeah. I have three books that I wanted to mention. One has been sort of a Bible for me, which has been The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey. I have read that book, listened to that book, and there are many times in life where I'm giving some piece of advice or I do something a certain way, and then I'll listen to the book again. I'm like, oh, that's where I learned it.
You forget sometimes,
I just think it's such a pivotal book and it's been so transformational on my life. And when we were talking about leadership earlier, so much about leadership is developing your own character. And this book really helps you do that. Then one that I'm reading recently, actually I have a half an hour left in the book. I have a background in fundraising, but I am in a sales role and we are both in sales roles because we're at the early stages of a company. And so a book that was recommended to me was To Sell as Human by Daniel Pink, which really flips the narrative on selling and basically says we're almost all selling, whether it's direct selling or indirect selling. It is a phenomenal book and really made me appreciate all of the aspects of selling. And then the last one is one I just finished, Why We Sleep by Matthew, I think it's Walker is his last name. And I think this might be a good recommendation for other people in the startup world because there's a tendency to choose sleep last. And I was looking for something that would flip the narrative in my own mind about sleep or lack thereof. And I needed something analytical and I needed something science-based. And this book was extraordinary and so pivotal for me in what will happen if we don't choose sleep and what we are doing to our bodies and why, that it has changed everything for me in the last 5 weeks or so about how I sleep.
Dawn actually jotting down, no pun intended, the names of these books as Natalie listed them off.
So, created a new list.
That was pretty funny to see, but also very cool to say like taking these kind of notes down. So we're almost through. And that was Rich's question. So thank you all for your really thoughtful answers to that. And now is an opportunity to ask a question to who we interview next.
Yeah. So
pretend you don't know who it is.
I'm going to pretend I don't know who it is. So this is something that I'm thinking about a ton right now. And so this is as much crowdsourcing ideas as anything. But I'd love to understand how this particular person creates healthy fear in his or her organization. I think it's something that I'm trying to balance right now. Is that I want a little bit of fear. I want people to sense that this is a startup and we're really in a do or die situation because, I mean, that's the reality. But on the other hand, I don't want there to be so much fear that people start to, you know, look for other places to go or become distracted or unmotivated by that, right? So I'm thinking a lot about how to have something called that I'm calling healthy fear. And I'd love to hear ideas on that.
That's a great question. And I think one that would be really, really interested to hear anybody's in this world's response to, because I think because of the nature of startups, I think it is like people are maybe not in that clear of a term, like
how do you do that?
Yeah, it could be very paralyzing if you go too far with the fear, where someone makes they're afraid to make a mistake, then you lose a lot of like kind of what makes a startup great is for people to, you know, be a little uncomfortable making the decision or doing something that may help the business.
Fascinating topic for sure.
Natalie, you've been in the slow burn, so you get to ask this person whom you don't know, you've never had a relationship with.
You don't even know their first name.
You get to ask them a question as well. We'll double them up.
Oh, wow. Okay. So I'd love to hear an answer for anyone who is thinking about being an entrepreneur, but is unsure of whether they should be, whether it's the right path for them. How somebody like that should go through the process of figuring that out for themselves. Awesome question.
That is a great question. You guys have pretty much officially survived this slow burn, and the reward that we give all of our guests is 30 seconds to plug anything. This can be a business, an event, an idea, literally whatever you want in 30 seconds or however long it takes.
Yeah. I'm going to plug Ann Arbor.
Awesome.
So I came here for college, but then I left and I was gone for a couple of decades and was sort of lured back here. And I have to say Ann Arbor has some amazing benefits. And I don't know if the whole rest of the world knows all the jewels we have here, but I moved here from New York, where hiring engineers or anything in the data realm was extremely difficult and extremely competitive. And here in Ann Arbor, we're just blessed with engineers everywhere. It's unbelievable. That's huge if you want to have a tech company.
For sure.
The quality of life here is fantastic. I always joke about the fact that everything in Ann Arbor is 15 minutes away by car and most of the things you can walk to.
Yeah.
And that there's not a lot of things here, but there's one of everything and it's super solid.
Yeah.
Like, I don't buy comic books, but that comic book store on Main Street is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
And it's like the only comic book store that we have, but it's fantastic, right?
Yeah.
And that's just kind of how Ann Arbor is. We have one of everything and it's awesome. And that's kind of all you need.
Yeah.
So I plug Ann Arbor.
Yeah. And being new to the area, I cannot say enough good things about it. And it's just such a welcoming community. And I'll do one extra plug specifically and also about Ann Arbor, that there's such an easy on-ramp into moving here and living here through Engage.
Yeah.
Right. So Brooke Boyle's program Engage, that is turning networking on its head, and it's all about connecting and really introducing anyone who comes here to other great people and places in Ann Arbor.
So you guys have survived. You did it. You made it through the slow burn and through the whole interview. We really appreciate your time together. I think we found a few topics we can maybe talk about again sometime. But thanks again for spending some time with us today. And I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
And that's our episode, everybody. If you had a blast like we did, make sure to subscribe to the show. If you're listening to it already, you might as well. It's available on Apple, Spotify, and everywhere else.
And hey, make sure to share all the love with the makers and breakers out there in your life. And thanks for listening, and keep your life on brand.
Life on Brand is a Huck Finch production. Make sure to check us out at huckfinch.com for all your branding needs. That website again is huckfinch.com.
Hey, it's me, your website. This is kind of awkward, but are you embarrassed of me? I mean, you don't show me off anymore or tell anybody about me. Worst of all, I know I have so much to offer you in helping you to find the best talent, to seducing your ideal customers, and articulating what your brand stands for. Huck Finch can help us. They specialize in crafting websites that solve business problems and are easy on the eyes. On top of that, they knock out websites in under 60 days, and their pricing is transparent, so there's no sticker shock. Give me the makeover I deserve. Learn more at huckfinch.com. Because an ordinary website just isn't enough.